I don't want to offend.
What if they misunderstand?
I'm scared to say what I feel.
What's wrong with me?
They're going to see what they want to see.
Everybody else seems fine.
Just say it. This is Jen Slumack. You're listening to the podcast, Just Say It, a show that aims to highlight the commonplaces among us. As we amplify a variety of voices, conversations, and questions, we hope and move together toward Dr. King's beloved community. Thank you for tuning in.
Ginny is a woman that I met through an organization, worldtrust.org in Oakland, and you were holding a virtual restorative justice event in Oakland. And it was a series of things, but one of the things that you were proposing at that, your organization seemed to be proposing or promoting there, was the possibility of people putting themselves in virtual reality situations to somewhat experience that which was an unjust America.
Correct.
So I was intrigued by that, and I definitely came, and I came with a friend of mine and her two babies. And we came and we saw you and Shakti, and you and I met. And since then, I've learned a lot more about your organization. And I have reached out to you recently to utilize one of the films that Shakti Butler has created. I don't know if you had a hand in it, called Mirrors of Privilege, Making Whiteness Visible, because I'm learning that in the present state of our nation, perhaps the biggest role and the best and most important role that I can play is in educating other white people about why we get so uncomfortable talking about race when it's so clearly an issue. So tell us, who are you?
So I am a human being.
Yes, ma'am.
I am a spirit. And I have done a lot of things in my life, and I'm sure we'll get into them. Right now, I work at World Trust. I work with Shakti Butler. I am passionate about justice, and I have been pursuing justice, I think, my whole life in one form or another. And I'm an activist, and I'm a feminist. And I am a lesbian, and I'm a lesbian feminist, and which is kind of its own category, or was anyway. I'm a scuba diver, and I don't know, probably lots of other things.
Okay. Well, we all are many things, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
And I am intrigued, and maybe one of these times we'll do, you can educate me on feminism and then feminism, lesbian feminism, and how the two are distinguished, because I am ignorant when it comes to those two things. I would love to talk to you more about that. Now, where we are in the world right now, tell me your thoughts. Tell me where you live, and then tell me about your place in the environment of where you live.
So I live in Oakland. I live in the Diamond District in Oakland. It's a mixed neighborhood. It's probably mostly white. But there are enough people of color for me to be able to call it a mixed neighborhood. It's an interesting neighborhood. We've lived here. My partner and I have lived in this house since 2011, so 9 years. It'll be 9 years in August, I think. And shortly after we moved into the neighborhood, about a year or so after we moved into the neighborhood, Trayvon Martin was killed in Florida. And he was killed for the crime of being a black man walking through a gated community where he was visiting his girlfriend. And Florida had, and I think they still have, a stand your ground law, which says that you can, if you feel threatened by somebody, you can kill them, basically. And so George Zimmer, did not know Trayvon Martin and saw a black man and thought that he was probably a burglar or a robber or who knows what, a criminal. and went after him and killed him. And this was just a terrible example of profiling. And shortly after that, my partner and I started to notice next door, the listserv, neighborhood listservs had just started up. And on next door, people in the neighborhood were writing horrible things. I saw a black man walking down the street in a hoodie. I didn't recognize him. I called the police. Two black men were driving up the street slowly, and then they made a U-turn and drove away. Very suspicious. Lots of stuff like that. I ran outside. There was a young black man in a hoodie. This was the key, apparently. It was a young black man in the hoodie, and I didn't recognize him. I ran outside with my phone to take his picture, and he ran away. That shows that he was a criminal. And this was just appalling to us. And both of us have been activists in the 60s and 70s, and I had done a lot of anti-racist work had been part of the work that I had been doing, and I felt like we needed to. I didn't want to approach what was happening on the listserv in the same way we approached it in the 70s, which was really to go, "You stupid racist," which was very ineffective, as you can imagine. And so I started asking some friends of mine who still do anti-racist work, that's their primary focus, how people are talking about it at that point. And everybody kept telling me that I should watch this movie called Cracking the Codes, The System of Racial Inequity, which I did, and I thought it was a great movie. And I also thought, but I don't know what to do with this. Right now, what we have here in the neighborhood is a lot of white people who are profiling black people, and it's dangerous. Black people are being killed. Trayvon Martin had just been killed for doing nothing more than being a black man who somebody thought shouldn't be where he was. So we put something out on the listserv and said, "This is very disturbing to us. Does anybody want to talk about it?" And some people came, said, "Yes, we want to talk about it," and came to our house. And, you know, all these years later, the group is five of the original people who came are still part of the group, which is now called Neighbors for Racial Justice. And so the kind of, you asked me what the environment is. And so the environment is there's over the years, as we've done our work, and our work has expanded beyond Next Door into all kinds of other projects, really focused on our neighborhood and sometimes on the city of Oakland. We have found that there's lots of people who are very supportive and want to be, I would say, allies. And there are lots of people who are very resistant and are very afraid, really. And so that's how it is in this part of Oakland. And I think in many parts of Oakland where there's a lot of white people.
Well, thank you for that. I wonder what you think. I tend to believe that, you know, you diagnosed it right when you said that, you know, some of the resistance is rooted in the fear. And that's, you know, human psychology, right?
Yeah.
And what we fail to do as a society is recognize that we are all built this way and operate this way when fear comes up, but that some of us are killed and some of us get to say it on a listserv. Like the imbalance is fatal.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's not, I mean, we're taught to be afraid. We are just, you look at the recent incident that happened with Amy Cooper in Central Park and her, you know, weaponizing that fear to which could have caused huge damage to the other Cooper, who was Mr. Cooper, Christian, I think his name is Cooper, who was just trying to watch birds. But we're taught to be afraid of, particularly of Black men. And we're taught it by all the media and by, you know, the kind of dog whistle politics that we hear from everyone, starting with, I don't even know when it started, but certainly in my lifetime, it started with Richard Nixon was doing it, where you don't actually, you find other ways to talk about scary Black people. You talk about welfare queens, you talk about, you know, super predators, you talk about, you never, because you can't say scary Black people anymore, but you find other ways to talk about it. And it's, and we learn about it in school, and there's no way to avoid it, really. And so it's really up to us then to be aware of that and to combat it, and to support the efforts that people make to present other images. You know, I mean, and just, and to, there's so much more, but that fear that we have is, it doesn't mean you're a bad person because you're afraid. It means that you have been taught to be afraid and you learned how to do it really well. And so now what you need to do is unlearn it, recognize it and unlearn it.
Yeah. I think that it's, without sounding condescending to all of us, in essence, it's time to grow up. You know, we've kind of been childish in allowing our fears and our emotional selves to run our voting or run our defense against each other's accusations. We need to learn to listen. We need to learn to say, I might not know the whole thing, right? I might not know everything. Maybe there's more that I could learn about something that I think I understand.
I think that's really right, Jen. I think it's, particularly in this time, it's up to white people, I think, to do two things. One is to shut up and listen, especially to listen to Black people and other people of color. And the other is to speak up to other white people. And to learn. But it's, you know, it's not just enough to learn. It's great. You could learn and you could be the most, I don't know, the smartest and most enlightened white person in the world. And that's great, but it's not enough.
Right.
There's a system here that is, that it's literally, it's got its foot on the neck of a whole lot of people. And as white people, we benefit from that. And so even if we are the most conscious person and don't want to benefit from it, we do. And so it's up to us to stop that, to interrupt it, to point it out, and to do it in a way that people can hear, so that they can move and change. Because this, it hurts all of us. The system it's just soul killing for everybody. And it's, you know, physically killing for particularly Black women and men.
Yeah, I agree. And sometimes I think we need to talk about the invisible things, so to speak, the spiritual and the soul, in order to really see what's happening. Let's talk about that for a second. You said that it's soul killing for all of us.
I think that I believe that we are all connected on some kind of a spiritual level, that we are really all one. And what we are taught is that we are not connected, that we're separate. You're on your own, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. So there's you and the people like you, and then there's others. And this othering that we are taught to do and that we do, and we all do it, around all kind of, anybody who's not like us for any one of a number of reasons, it creates a separation. And that separation keeps us from being connected. And our connection is the best thing about us, I think. It's what our connectedness is what, I don't know.
It's what generates life.
That's right. It's what generates life.
Yeah.
And that's right. That's exactly right. It generates life and it puts us in our full power and potential as human beings.
Yeah.
And you know, it's if you've ever loved anybody, which I'm sure you have, and all of your listeners have, if you can to sustain those feelings of love, to be in that state, is the great state to be in. And if you are afraid, and if you see, you know, most of the world as other and as not like you and as a need to push them away, need to keep them away, then you can't be in that state of love. And that's soul killing. That's what I mean by soul killing. It's like you're offered a plate full of fabulous, healthy, delicious food, or you're offered a plate with some pebbles on it. And that's kind of the choice that we have. And we're told the pebbles are really good for you. They will make you strong and healthy. And that's just not true.
That's right. I love that. I love that analogy. You know, I believe that we each have a piece of one soul in us and it's reaching for each other. And we have these minds that construct barriers. And that's the challenge is, you know, self-will that was a gift to us, so to speak, if you go that route, you know, our ability to think for ourselves and to create, our imagination can be used to create life or to destroy life, right? And our mind imagines separations. We've imagined things into reality that are not necessarily true, and they keep us separated from joining as one spirit. You know, I believe it was Mother Teresa who said, and I'm going to butcher it, I'm sorry, Mother Teresa, but the gist was, you know, the greatest unrest or the greatest pain in human history is that we've forgotten that we belong to each other.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's it.
That's
I think
beautiful.
It's that simple. Now, that said, I think that we also have this idea that people of color and others need to catch up with whites. The whites that are sort of sitting in this place of, oh, well, they're going to figure it out. I don't need to deal with it, are sort of the mindset, the ones that I've spoken to, are of the mindset that those people will have to figure this stuff out. But what I believe, particularly after having gone to the Women's March in 2017 after the elections and seeing everybody who has ever had to felt compelled to have a, you know, a march in our country's history, independently of each other, was there in the streets. Black people, white people, Latinx people, gay, straight, families, everybody was there, different religions embracing each other against the idea that we don't belong together. And that made me sort of think that we all understand that we need each other, and the odd one out is no longer the others that we've called others. The odd one out now is the white moderate who doesn't recognize that they're missing out.
Yeah, that's really true. And it's really, you know, what you said about it's up to them to catch up with us, it really, really does miss the point. And the point is that everybody has something to offer. And it's our loss, really, that we think, anybody's loss, who thinks that what they know already and the culture that they live in is the culture. And it's, I mean, one of the things that I learned and one of the things that's, I think, hard for white people, that's certainly been hard for me, is all the ways that our whiteness shows up in some of the ways that we do things that we think are the only way to do things. And we think that because that's what we were told, that's all we know. But there is so much richness in other cultures as well. I mean, if you can imagine, for example, just music and what African-American people have brought to American music and how that has impacted the music, that most white Americans listen to. They used to, when everybody used to listen to rock, that was the music, and that was heavily influenced by African American music. And if you think about, jazz, and if you think about the blues, and if you think just that, and there's so much more, and how much if you listen to music, how much richer your life is because you're not just limited to, I don't even know if there are pure white forms of music, but whatever those would be. But what we lose when we close ourselves off, when we think that our way is the only way, whether it's around music or whether it's around how to run a meeting, which is something that, I had to learn about, that there's other ways to run a meeting or to have a meeting other than the way that I learned about my whole life. And they're different and they're interesting and there's different outcomes and there's more possibility. And I like that you talked about imagination. We're not really encouraged to use our imaginations, and none of us are, and certainly not in school. We're like, no, you must follow the rules and learn the test and do this and don't think about that. And why are you daydreaming? And come back to learning about these facts about this war. And it's a great loss for us. And that's another way that, that it's soul killing. It's just like, yeah, there's so much out there and we keep ourselves from it and we are kept from it.
Yeah. How did you get involved with World Trust? How did you meet Shakti? I heard you say that you saw the video. Somebody introduced you to the video. Perhaps that was your introduction. Can you tell us more about how you got where you are with that organization and what you do?
I had left my job. I'd been working for many years, I think 14 years, at the National Federation of Community Broadcasters, which was headquartered in Oakland, is no longer in Oakland. And we were working with about 250 non-commercial community radio stations around the country. And I did a lot of different things with them. I left that job and I was unemployed for a while. And one of the women who came to that very first Neighbors for Racial Justice meeting and is still part of the group was working with Shakti in World Trust. And I was looking for a job, and World Trust, after I don't know how long, 6 months or a year of us, Lisa and I, working together in Neighbors for Racial Justice, World Trust posted a job that I saw for a web person and a social media person and somebody who could do some writing. What I know about web design and social media would fit on the head of a pin, but I can write. And Lisa said, well, go ahead, apply for the job. And I said, I don't know how to do this stuff. I'm not a digital native, but I can learn, but I'm never going to be great at it. It's not my language. And I got an interview, and that's when I met Shakti, and she hired me on the spot. We just really connected right away. And at the time I was hired to, at the time we had, I think, 6 or 7 different facilitators, of which Shakti was one, that we worked with. And so my initial job was to book them. People were calling and emailing about meeting workshops and speakers and training and like that. And so I started doing that. I met all the facilitators, I started working them. And over time, Shakti and I got much closer and I started working more closely with her. And I still do that. I still do the bookings for our facilitators. And I do a lot of work with Shakti around planning, and we do a lot of writing together of proposals, not funding proposals, but, you know, an organization wants to bring us in, and I will talk to them and about what we have to offer, and then I have to write it up for them, or it's a, we just are starting a very, very big job with the Marin County Department of Health and Human Services. It's going to be at least a year-long job. And so I do all, you know, I do stuff like that. We're a very small organization. And so in these small organizations, as I'm sure you know, you do what needs to be done.
The work is really important. It's fine that you don't understand the web and the social media. I do, and sometimes it's the death of me. I mean, I get lost in the weeds all the time. I don't want to do it. I want to tell stories. I want to curate stories. I want to love people and bring people together in safe spaces. And I want to inspire a desire to grow closer to each other. That's what I want to do on this planet. And if you can find that job description, I would be thrilled to apply. But otherwise, you know, we have to do what we have to do,
That's right.
You know, to pay the bills and then try to also give the world some of our heart. Right.
Right.
So thank you for the work that you do. And I'm hopeful that I'll have the opportunity to also interview Shakti Butler, because I think that she's an amazing woman, and the work that she's doing and creating the cracking of the codes. And there's two more videos out.
We have five altogether. We have five films altogether, yeah.
Yeah, Cracking the Codes, Mirrors of Privilege, and...
The Way Home was the first movie she made, and that's a really interesting film about... It's over the course of a year, there were eight councils of women set up, groups of about, I don't know, 8 or 10 women, and they met for a year. And the councils were, there was an African-American, a Latina, Asian Pacific Islander, Native American, Arab American, Jewish American, multiracial, and who am I leaving out? I don't know. I'm leaving somebody out.
Okay.
And white. Thank you, white. And they met over the course of a year, and they
were
filmed.
White people are getting forgotten. That's good news. I swear, we're on the cusp of something here.
Yeah. Anyway, so, and they just talked about their identity, and they talked about some of the things that they struggled with, and their internalized oppression, and their understanding of their own ethnicity, and. And it was it's a really good film, because you get to be a fly on the wall in conversations that you could never get into. Huh. And it was very instructive, actually, for me. And then the leaders of each of the councils met together, and that resulted in the film Light in the Shadows. And that is a very interesting film. It's basically those women talking to it, like eight women talking to each other. And it's very, there's not conflict, but there's a lot of people are push on each other. And it's interesting. And it's really about how to stay at the table when the conversation gets hot, what gets hard, which it does in that movie.
Yeah.
And then Mirrors of Privilege and Cracking the Codes. And then the newest one is Healing Justice, which is about the justice system and trauma. And how we heal from trauma, and how the justice system could be actually a system that results in healing rather than, punishment.
Well, and that's the one that I was primarily interested in, come to think of it, that drew me to the organization, because I have worked in the prisons and the jails as an instructor, and have always been in this wrestling match with myself about, you know, being implicit, you know, being complicit with the system, being going in there and being employed within it, and earning a decent paycheck. But also my big motivation was to bring some light into the darkness, right? Was to bring some, you know, touch people with humanity in a place that didn't allow it, right?
Yeah.
So it's a complex series of issues. And I think if we can face this racial reconciliation, I mean, we all have similar experiences differently. And if we can acknowledge the difference in the way that we experience the same things, now we're coming together and becoming far more powerful and being able to create spaces that are far more accommodating to all of us, so that we can heal different things together.
Mm-hmm. And to say nothing of healing the earth, which is really in need of a lot of help right now.
Yeah.
I mean, I just read a story this morning about, a huge oil spill in the Arctic Ocean that leaked from a power plant in Russia. And it leaked because the pillars supporting the plant were in permafrost, which is thawing. And it's, why is it thawing? Because we're having, because the planet is heating up. You know, global warming, which is causing the permafrost to defrost, which creates another environmental disaster, and on and on and on and on. And it's all, to me, it's all part of what you're talking about, is all part, it's all one system, and it's a system of power that basically posits that there is somebody on top, and the job of the people on top is to keep the people underneath everything, not just the people, animals, and the planet underneath them, and to maintain the position of topness at all costs. And it, you know, it shows up in a million different ways. It's white on top of people of color. It's human beings on top of animals, and it's human beings on top of nature, and it's men on top of women, and it's straight people on top of queer people, and it's it's cisgender people on top of trans. It's everything is set up this way so that there's always somebody on top, and then your job is to make sure that whoever is right under you does not get any closer to coming up equal with you. And that's what we have to stop.
Well, and I think that what's happening, if maybe I'm naive, maybe I'm idealistic, and maybe I'm right. I don't know which is true. But here's what I think. Everybody who has experienced from some angle of the power structure being kept as an under is beginning to recognize each other and is seeing for the first time that the people causing the problem are a minority. And their power is in our believing that what they say or do or uphold is true or right or unchangeable.
Well, I hope you're right, but I think there's movement, but I don't think we're there yet.
Well, I don't think it's going to happen tonight.
But wouldn't that be nice?
But the system is built in such a way where you can no longer find a human being to name, right? The criminal justice system, just working within it for 7 years, I mean, you can never find the person who has the solution to the problem. It's always somebody else's job. There's no accountability in the systems of power. There's no accountability to the guidelines and the expectations of the laws set up for the rest of society. The person that should answer for it is elusive. You can't find them. And that's part of, go ahead.
No, I think that's true, but I think that those people that you can't find are, in a certain sense, the middle managers. And I think we know who's at the top. I think when you look at billionaires, I mean, I think it's basically, who is running these giant corporations that have put over and over again, put profit ahead of people? Who runs Amazon? We know who runs Amazon. We know who the billionaires are. We know who, I mean, I don't even know all the, because I don't put a lot of attention on that, but we know that there is we know who benefits from the capitalist system. We know who benefits. And I'm not, so when we talk about, you know, white privilege or male privilege, and we can say, well, all men benefit from male privilege, all white people benefit from white privilege. And that's true. And we are not at the top of the pyramid. the top of the pyramid is you know, it is the 1%, and it is, and we can name them, and it is, you know, the Koch brothers, you know, all the people who are supporting Donald Trump. And I don't mean all the people, I mean the money people who are supporting Donald Trump. They are at the top. What they do that is so successful is convince the people, convince us who are under them, that the only threat to us is coming from the people underneath us. And that's how they, you know, that's, and so that's how they keep our eyes on the people underneath us rather than on the people above us who have the power. And I think we know who they are. We may not know who, you know, in a particular situation, it's impossible to find out how to make a change in the prison system, but we know what has to happen for there to be a real change in the prison system, and we know who has the power to do that. I believe that to make change at this point, we need to not be looking there at the, you know, the big picture, but here in our own backyards. What can we do here? How can we make change here? How do we want to live today? How do we want our neighborhoods to be today? How do we want our communities to be today? And, you know, use our imagination and really think about, you know, how can we turn this street, how can we turn this empty lot into, maybe we want a park? Well, maybe we can make a park. And if we can make a park and bring our neighborhood together to make a park, then we can take on the next thing and the next thing. But we don't know, we don't feel like we know how to, we don't feel like we have any power. We don't feel like we have any control. And the only place where we can have that control and that power right now is locally. That's part of why I think these demonstrations that are going on all over the country and all over the world are so important, because people are focused on, they're focused on police brutality, but they're focused on a bigger issue than that, which is systemic racism. And they're also focused on the local police department in their city has to change. And that's why, I may be marching for justice for George Floyd, but I am also marching because the Oakland Police Department is out of control. And that's something I can do something about.
So now we're talking about the circle of influence and the circle of concern, so to speak, like being able to touch what we can touch and knowing that it will ripple into the larger,
yes,
the larger world.
I want to tell you another story, okay?
Yeah.
So I think this is relevant. So many, many years ago, I was one of a group of women who started a women's record company. This was in 1973. And it was called Olivia Records. And
Olivia Records.
Yes.
I know Olivia Records. Thank you. Go ahead.
You're welcome. And we had a big, big plan. And our idea was that by starting a record company and doing, and it was about so much more than putting out music. It was about, we envisioned ourselves as ultimately having hundreds, if not thousands of women working with us. We were going to have our own pressing plant. This was when the records were pressed vinyl. So we were going to have our own pressing plant. We were going to have our own, and they came in jackets, paper, cardboard jackets. We were going to have our own jacket fabrication plant. We were going to have our own recording studios. We were going to have a distribution network all over the country. Everybody was going to get really well paid. They were going to be really well treated. Everybody was going to have an opportunity to learn new skills and to eventually become part of the decision-making collective, because we operated collectively, and everybody who wanted to would have an opportunity to do that. And so all these thousands of women were gonna come to work every day, and we were gonna say, and by the way, this is called feminism. And they were gonna go, oh, well then I'm a feminist, because this is how I wanna be treated. This is how I wanna live my life. Okay. And so that was part of the idea. And then there was also all this great music and all this opportunity for for women musicians and concert production companies and, you know, and on and on and on. And ultimately what we wanted to do was, what we thought we were going to do was overthrow capitalism and the patriarchy.
Yeah. This is in 73, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
In 73. And so, as you may have noticed, we did not do that. We did not overthrow the patriarchy or capitalism. Because we had this, but what we did do turns out to have been really important. Not as good as overthrowing the patriarchy and capitalism, but putting out a lot of great music that really reflected women's lives, really helping to build community, getting women to have a lot of skills. So my point is, and building a lot of networks, and well, we did some other things too, but that's, my point is that, it was great to have that goal. What we did do was much smaller, but it was very powerful. And if all we had thought about was how are we going to overthrow capitalism, we never would have done smaller things that we were able to do and that were extremely important in building community and connection and I hate to use the word, but it's, I don't know what else to say, and really empowering women. So
I have to ask you this. Do you know Shirley Chisholm or Gloria Steinem?
Personally?
Yeah.
No. Okay. I mean, I've met Gloria Steinem, but I never met Shirley Chisholm.
So the first issue of Miss Magazine came out in 72, I think, if I'm not mistaken. And so that, so do you think that had any, you think that audacity had anything to do with the minds churning up Olivia Records? That era?
It was a time, definitely. Yeah. It was definitely a time. And I had come out of the Furies, which was a very important and very, and actually there's a film that's about to come out about the Furies. The Furies was a lesbian, feminist, separatist collective in Washington, D.C. Put out a newspaper called The Furies. We put it out for about a year. And in fact, the house where the paper was put out on Southeast 11th Street was recently made, it's in the National Historical Registry now. Yeah, so, and some of us, and so I had come out of The Furies, as had some of the other original Olivia people, because when I came out of The Furies, I was lovers with Meg Christian, who was a musician doing performing in nightclubs in Washington, and we became lovers, and I started booking her, getting her jobs at women's centers and women's colleges, and I didn't know what I wanted to do for my next political work, and then we had this idea that Chris Williamson actually planted. Of starting a women's record company. So, but there was a tremendous explosion of creative energy in the late 60s and early 70s as a result of, for me, it was the women's liberation movement and then the gay liberation movement. It was like, oh, I actually get to be who I am. I don't have to pretend.
So, Jenny, let me ask you a question about that. What do you think, if any, is the relationship between the explosion of liberation that was happening in the 60s and the 70s for women, for queers, for the civil rights, and the assassination of King and the Kennedys and Malcolm X? How do you think that is related to white complacency today?
How is it related to white complacency? What do you mean by?
I have often thought about, and please, if you're listening, I am not making excuses for it. I am wondering about explanations for it. I have a mind that likes to think things through. I wonder if that time period when all of the unrest and the revolution and the summer of love and the feminist, all of this stuff that was happening to break through the old ideas, was looking to, it was moving into politics. It was getting, Dr. King was assassinated after he started talking about the Poor People's Campaign. Mm-hmm. He started talking about Vietnam. I mean, he wasn't just talk, it's almost like the powers that be were willing to allow blacks and whites to hang out together in the streets and talk about things, but don't get too close. And when we started talking about capitalism or poverty, and we started talking about the things that would in fact begin dismantling the foundation of the 1%, so to speak, people were killed. People who brought hope to a lot of us in that soup of otherness. And I wonder if the willingness to have hope at that time and then have it stolen the way that it was from a generation hasn't handed itself down in its own quiet trauma that no longer manifests as hope, but as I need to keep mine safe and I'm not willing to hope.
Well, that's interesting. I think that, I mean, I don't know, maybe, that's just not my experience, but that may be, I think a lot of people, a lot of activists got burned out for sure. And a lot of activists actually got killed. A lot of black activists in particular got killed. Malcolm X and Martin Luther King were the most famous, but they were not the only. Fred Hampton,
right,
was, and there were others. I think that there is actually that this is a right now. I have a lot of hope right now. If that is in fact true, what you're saying, which it may be, I think that what's happening right now is very hopeful because it is young people who are leading what's going on now. I think on Monday, the city of Oakland announced the 8 o'clock curfew. And am I allowed to say the F word?
Yeah.
Okay. But so they organized, we've got all over email and social media, a demonstration called for Tuesday night. The Oakland curfew was supposed to go into effect at 8 p.m. They called for a demonstration at 14th and Broadway at 8.05 p.m. And it was called F the Curfew. And it was, there were like 15 grassroots, mostly black-led, young, mostly youth-led organizations that came together like that to call for this demonstration. And several thousand people showed up Tuesday night at 8.05 and took over that whole area in front of City Hall in downtown Oakland. And the police and the instructions were, be prepared to be arrested. This is what you should bring with you. This is what you should not bring with you. And the police stayed away. People stayed until after 10 o'clock at night. And people are still, the Anti-Police Terror Project in Oakland organized in 2 days this massive rally last Sunday, which was the drive, the car caravan for George Floyd. And 1,000 cars went into it. I mean, these things are happening. They're happening with coalitions of groups that are led by people of color, by young people of color. And they're not stopping. And these folks, and these are not organizations that just, came into existence 2 weeks ago. These folks have been organizing for years. They know what they're doing. They have actually, they know how to use social media, and they have actually learned from some of the mistakes that we made. And it gives me great hope. And I think that there is a crack in the system right now, and that we are seeing this crack, and it gives me great hope. So I can't answer your question, but I actually am more hopeful now than I've felt in years. And I'm a pretty optimistic person.
And I have to tell you, I know one of the young men who was leading in the F the Curfew evening. He's one of the gentlemen that I have interviewed. He's amazing. He's 26, maybe. And he has been fully involved in putting together education and liberation and all sorts of things for people of color, men of color. I've interviewed some guys who, you know, returning from jail or prison, and what they're doing to provide mentorship for other men who didn't have access to men mentors. I agree with you that the time is very, very hopeful, and that the response that I'm seeing is, while I believe long overdue, I'm close to people who have lost many people to gun violence and being killed by police officers, and their families' names never got the hashtag.
Right.
And there's so many. Like I would like to create sort of like the AIDS quilt for Black mm-hmm. Lives Matter, because I think that the world needs to see, you yeah. know, that was one of the most powerful things that the gay community, I think, has provided this country, is some of the ways to move towards change in solidarity, you know, and to take something that is a taboo and really explode it on the scene for making us look. So my inquiry about what were your thoughts about those assassinations in that time having to do with white, you know, whites being quiet and not acting or standing up. I wonder if that's true, but even if it is, I feel like this generation is answering for it, mm-hmm. answering it. Right. But I saw the most darling and ridiculous thing the other day that just warmed my heart. And it was about 12 or 13 young white kids with handwritten Black Lives Matter signs standing in the middle of this little white community intersection and generating a lot of honks and a lot of waves and a lot of smiles and a lot of, I think it speaks to our desire to belong to something greater than ourselves.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think I think it's so clear what's wrong also. The two images that are, I think, are so critical to this. One is the cop with his knee on George Floyd's neck, and the way that he looked, the self-satisfied, smug way that he looked. And the other was, well, this man is saying, "I can't breathe," and the other cop's standing there watching them. The other is I go back to the Central Park incident, because a lot of white people have been saying about all of these killings of Black people, well, you know, he resisted arrest, or she was clearly mentally ill, or his cell phone could have been thought to be a gun, or had just stolen a candy bar or sold a cigarette. So there's always some reason why. And it's not really a cop. It's not really racism. It's,
forgive me, but I just have to say this. And those are the things that we have become okay with justifying murder for.
That's right.
It's disgusting.
Exactly right. Yes, it is.
Well, there was a tiny wrong, and so they deserved. No, we're talking about homicide. We're talking about snuffing out the story that is connected to generations.
That's right.
We're talking about somebody's father, somebody's son, uncle, cousin, child, teacher, mentor. This person is leaving a hole in a community that is already destabilized by intergenerational trauma dating back so far. And we cannot continue to rape the community of its connection to itself and blame it on theft of a candy bar. Okay.
You know, I think that's completely right. And I want to say, this is not an excuse, but this is what we were learned. This is what we have been taught.
Right.
This is how the system works. This is how the system works. Okay. The Amy Cooper thing, however, is like, there is no nuance here. There's no subtlety here. There's no There's no way that this guy is doing anything but trying to watch birds. And it is so clearly an example of white entitlement and white privilege and, you know, and white fear of black men using this weapon of, I'm going to call the police. That's and right. Say that an African-American man is threatening me. And she has to know that the act of doing that is a terrible threat to him. Right. And she talks about doing it anyway. Right. And so that these two things to me are like, this is what finally I think got us to this tipping point. What I hope is a tipping point.
I can't even find the words anymore, Jenny. I'm struggling to find the words.
A lot of the black people that I know after the election and when all the white people were freaking out were going like, hey, this is nothing new. This is welcome to my world.
That's right.
But
I think that's similar to the George Floyd. I think black people are saying, this is nothing new. Welcome
to
my world. And white people are saying, oh my God, I can't believe it.
That's right.
It has to get so bad that even the comfortable folks who aren't paying attention are rattled.
Yeah. People get moved by different things.
Yeah.
And if this is, you know, it's, as you said, it's not going to happen tonight, but it's happening. It is happening.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
Your Neighbors for Racial Justice gatherings. Is there any format for that that could be duplicated? Is that something that we can provide as a resource?
We have a website, which is neighborsforracialjustice.org.
Okay.
And when we can go out again and be in a room with a human being, and what we have helped several other neighborhoods form similar organizations, and we're happy to help others. And there's resources on the website for some ideas about how to do it, and we have a Facebook page too.
Awesome.
I don't know if it's Neighbors with the number 4 Racial Justice or the word FOR for both of them. It might be the number.
Okay.
Everything we do is, and we have a PowerPoint that we take around about racial profiling, we take around to community groups, and we do a weekly vigil. Actually, ever since Eric Garner was killed, we've been doing a vigil on the corner of Fruitvale and MacArthur on Saturday afternoons, Black Lives Matter, End White Silence, End White Violence vigil, and we did a community conversation after Robin DiAngelo was in Oakland. We did a follow-up community conversation, which 60 white people came to talk more about white fragility. We have done a couple of showings of Cracking the Codes. We did a showing of Healing Justice. We do all kinds of stuff. We've been involved in different coalitions and
And all of this is volunteer work.
Absolutely. 100%.
All of this is for the good of humanity.
This is for the good of us. This is our neighborhood. We live here. We want to live in a better neighborhood. And so we're going to make it happen.
Well,
I think we will help anybody else do that.
That goes back to your point of what can I affect in my reach,
right?
And how can we create safe spaces for the difficult conversations where we are? Is there anything that you didn't get a chance to talk about that you really feel like you would like to?
I just want to mention that I have a book coming out. Hopefully in the fall. It's been postponed because of COVID-19. It's called Olivia on the Record, A Radical Experiment in Women's Music. And it's about the founding and the early days of Olivia Records and what a really great experiment it was and the great joy and the great struggles. So it's coming out on Ant Loot Books, which is a Bay Area, San Francisco, multicultural, queer press. I'm very excited.
Well, I'm going to have to look up that press. I think that's awesome that that exists. And
yep.
I'm very excited to read your book. You can bet your ass that I'm going to get a copy. And if you don't mind, I'd even like to promote it when it is released. Let me know and I'll, you know.
I'd love it. Sure.
Yeah. I think you're amazing. And I so appreciate your time. And I so appreciate your life's work and its contribution to our world. Thank you so much, Jenny.
You're very welcome. Back at you, really.
Right on. This has been another episode of Just Say It. I am your host, Jen Slumak. I don't want to thank you for coming by. I encourage you to go to my website, www.soulnotskin.com. Tell your friends if you enjoyed the episode, and we'll see you next time.